Hello and welcome to Developing Perspective. Developing Perspective is a podcast discussing news of note in iOS development, Apple, and the like. I'm your host, David Smith. I'm an independent iOS and Mac developer based in Herndon, Virginia. This is show number 103. Today is Tuesday, January 8th. Developing Perspective is never longer than 15 minutes, so let's get started. All right, so the topic I'm going to be talking about today, it relates to some, I guess we could call it best practice, some lessons learned, some things like that. And this is coming out of a great series of articles that I've linked in the show notes that got started by a post by Ash Furrow talking about the seven deadly sins of a modern Objective-C. And there was a great follow-up to that written by Brett Simmons on Inessential, talking about some of those and adding into some of his own. And there just are a lot of really good things to kind of talk about. And this is, if you haven't really sort of caught on, this is going to be a fairly technical question. This is a technical episode talking about, you know, fairly low-level things, that an iOS developer or a Mac developer would be want to be aware of, would want to think about, and would want to be kind of be, you know, sort of have wrap their arms around. This isn't one of my higher level, more kind of hand wavy ones. So first, I'm going to start off by talking about where it all started, which is, you know, Ash Furrow's post, "The Seven Deadly Sins of the Modern Objective-C." And the first one he talks about, which I very much agree with, is it's very dangerous to have one big nib file or zip file. And really, what you're trying to avoid there is you're trying to avoid the situation where, A, there's the performance hit of having this massive view hierarchy all put into a nib, because you have to load all of that dynamically or at once when it loads. And there's, you know, ways you can get around that in storyboarding. But it's very dangerous to have too much of interface in one nib file. You can load multiple nibs. And this is actually an example of something that I do in Check the Weather, for example, where it's all the actual layout is all done with all the different components or different nibs, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. The top, the left, right, and bottom are all individual nibs, as well as the main dashboard, if you're familiar with the app or if you can go look it up. But they're all loaded independently, rather than putting it into one big nib file and then just moving views around. And a lot of that is for the performance reason. You know, I don't load the side panels until the first time the user wants to do it. And it's something that I think in general is something that you really want to, you know, sort of make sure that you avoid. And it's just it's good practice and good cleanliness, too, to separate as much as you can things into different concerns. The next thing I want to talk about, which is his number two, is not using dot syntax consistently. A lot of people go on back and forth about dot syntax and whether it's the right thing to do. Usually what it comes down to is it all depends on where your background is. If you're a long-time Objective-C programmer who has been doing it since before the dot syntax was introduced, you are probably, you know, anti it. If you're coming from a language like Java, where it's essentially that's the way that you would think about it, you're probably more apt to use it. Generally, I think the best thing he's saying here is make sure you're using it consistently. I think dot syntax works really well, and the way I tend to use it is I tend to use it pretty much exclusively for properties. That's pretty much the only, which, and essentially it's properties accessing, you know, internal IVARs. I never use dot syntax when calling a method, or even though you could. I've seen an interesting thing recently. Someone was talking about how they've started using it for methods without side effects, which I'm not so sure I'm convinced on either, because then you start getting into, well, how do you define a side effect? How do you know if it has a side effect? An example of that would be calling, for example, dot class on something, so it sort of condenses it. But anytime you're using something, you have to make sure you use it consistently, and I think that's the more important thing. The rest of his things, there's not a lot that I necessarily wanted to get into because I didn't have as strong opinions about, but I wanted to move over into Brett Simmons' response, which I think had a ton of really good ones. And his blog post is titled "Coders in the Hands of an Angry God," which is obviously, you know, as a follow-up to Seven Deadly Sins of the Modern Objective-C. And I think the thing that he said that really caught my attention and something that I've been thinking about but never really got into. One of the things Ash mentioned is that he says we don't do enough automated testing. And I think that's probably maybe true. I come from a Rails background where that was a much bigger thing. But in Objective-C, I've never found a really good way to do it. And it's really hard and it's really annoying and there's not great tools for it. And a lot of people say, well, you know, you just need to work on it, and that would, you know, encourage tool makers and so on. But the reality is I don't, you know, automated testing doesn't necessarily, it only pays off in very, very narrow areas in applications, especially because a lot of it's UI-based and all these types of problems that are tricky. There's a lot of asynchronous code, especially since GCD was introduced in iOS 4. Like, there's a lot of things that make it really tricky to do good test coverage. But I think Brett's response is, I think, very, very reasonable, and something that I've been looking for, and I think this is a great way, is instead of that, to start introducing more NS asserts into my code. If you're not familiar with it, basically NS assert is you say NS assert, and then you pass in two parameters. You pass in an expression who should resolve to a Boolean, and a description, basically. And if that Boolean ever evaluates to false, I think it is, or yeah, I think it's false. The assertion will blow up, and your app will stop, and you'll get be told this assertion, the thing that you said should always be true, is in fact not. And the reality of what that does is it lets you put these checks into your code that'll catch problems much more quickly. And I think he has a great example. NS assert not NS thread as main thread is what he's testing for. And so it's a great way to put that into some code that you know should only ever be called in the background. And so if it is called on the main thread, you want it to you want that to be very aware, and you want to be very so when you're testing, you're going to catch that. Now, the only thing that's tricky with NS assert is, in theory, it should be fine to leave in there for production once you've deployed it. But it always makes me a little nervous when I'm putting in something in my code that I know will crash, rather than putting the app into a funny state. That's always a kind of a tricky thing. And in theory, if you're writing good assertions, it shouldn't matter. But that's the only part that I'm always a little uneasy about. But generally speaking, that just means you have to be very careful and thoughtful about how you use them, rather than going sort of just putting them in willy-nilly. The next areas that I wanted to talk about is something that Brent actually had a whole blog post about, which is talking about the UI table view cell is not a controller. And there's been a whole series of things that he talked about this, but the big thing that I think he mentioned here that I thought was really clever or is important is that it's to try as much as we can to make sure that our UI table view cells don't know very much about the model they're displaying. For them not to turn into the controller, for them to not be doing a lot of the stuff that should really be outside of them. That a UI table view cell should really just be a display. It shouldn't really care too much about what it's displaying. This is something I know I've run into myself, where it's often easy to think, well, I'll just do a custom table view cell. I'll pass in my model object, and then the cell will take care of displaying that. And then I've gotten bitten by that. An example of that is where in my audiobooks app, I display a lot of books, so I have a custom table view cell for displaying a book, a title, an author, a type, those types of things. And most of the time, it's all coming out of, my core data object is what I'm displaying. It's my book object. But there's an area where I display popular books, and those are actually coming out of a JSON blob, and so they're actually a dictionary. And so it's kind of awkward where I was originally doing some hard coding to be pulling directly from book, NS managed object, and suddenly it's like, that doesn't really work, and I have to re-architect and change it. And I think what he's saying here is very true, where you just want to make sure that your UI table view cells are as sort of dumb as to what they're displaying as possible. You can do that in a couple of different ways, but what you never want to do is really create a tight coupling between your model and a UI table view cell. You want to put something in between there that gives you much more flexibility down the road. Other things he talks about that I think are really good, not turning on HOSI level warnings or not treating warnings as errors. These are just kind of obvious things where the LLVM especially is an amazing compiler. And if you're doing things that, LLVM can tell you tons of problems with your code well before you actually would need to or far earlier than you'd notice them. And so anything that it tells you is probably it's like, this is a warning. This is something you might not want to do. It's probably something you don't want to do. It's just in general. And I would say I've been doing this for a long time, but the compiler is still 10 times smarter than I am. So be careful about that. And same thing with the static analyzer. Make sure every static analyzer issue you address. The static analyzer is very smart. It's doing catching really low level problems that you'd almost certainly not be able to, at least not right away. He talks about making sure you're looking at the crash logs in iTunes Connect. I've recently found this to be really helpful. I think since iOS 5, when iCloud was introduced, and I believe crash reports are now sent automatically rather than having to be done via iTunes Sync. There's tons of them usually. They're really helpful. I've been able to track down lots of little problems with that. And anytime I do, anytime I do an update, the first thing I do, or the last thing I do, the first thing of the actual submission process is I go in and make sure that I've addressed all of those. I pull up, you know, refresh the report list in iTunes Connect. It's really helpful. You don't have to do your own crash reporting or any kind of mechanism like that. It's just all baked into iTunes Connect and very helpful. Another thing is putting things in .h files that shouldn't be public. And this is something that I used to do a lot and have recently been trying really hard to fight against. And I think it's really helped to really clean up my code. Is basically there is – it's a little tricky in the way that Objective-C does structures things because you don't have the same level of if you're coming from a Java background where you had like the four levels of of publicity, basically was it public, protected, private, and class – something like that. It's been a long time since I did good Java. So, but anyway, what you really want to do is especially if you're going to be putting properties or things for a class that no one else should be aware of, put them as a class extension in the .m file. Don't put them in the .h file. The .h file should be as simple and straightforward as possible because you have to remember the person who's going to be having to work out how this class works is probably going to be you. And as smart as you think you are, your future self is likely not as smart as you. So be careful about that. Other things that he says that I think are really good is making sure you use Pragma Mark, which is just a great way to structure and organize your code. And the last one I want to talk about is using instruments for performance testing and memory analysis. And I think this has become especially helpful and important as the platform has sort of improved and developed over time, that you're getting, there's a lot of these things where the things that are going to be able to differentiate your application is going to be speed and performance and reliability in a way that, it's like, even look at something like a weather app, right? I was building an app that was competing in a space that was incredibly competitive. I mean, there is a whole category with thousands of apps that do this. How do you differentiate yourself? And one of the things you have to do there is to work hard on performance and those types of things. I spent huge amounts of time in instruments doing, looking at all where what are the slow parts of my app? How can I improve that? Looking for hiccups and bugs, looking for memory load over time. All these kinds of problems that you can improve your application in a way that the user may not necessarily notice in a way that is tangible. It's not like having an impressive graphic design or something where people are going to see it directly. But I think people notice, and it's kind of that latent, this is a good app. It's fast. It's performant. And you, of course, want to also be doing your performance testing on slow devices. I think right now my typical baseline is the iPhone 4, which I think gives me a pretty good coverage. It's not the 3GS I'll sometimes use, but it's not as much of something that I use these days, just mostly because it doesn't it's a relatively small percentage of users in my case that use that. I think it's about, actually, I'm bringing up the stats. It's about 6% of my users are using 3GSs, which is a pretty low number. Whereas compared to the iPhone 4, it's about 35%. And if you go with, iPhone 4 and up, it's 94%. So if I can use the iPhone 4 as a basis, I think it gets pretty good coverage, even though the 3GS technically supports iOS 6 and all those kinds of things. But that's typically what I've been doing as a performance base, and it seems to work pretty well, especially because the 4 was the first of the A processors. I think it was the A4 inside of it, which is gives you a really strong baseline to be working from. You can do a lot. If you're trying to get 60 frames a second animations and things, that's something that is usually possible on an iPhone 4. In some places on the 3GS, you just can't do it. So anyway, those are just some of these thoughts. Like I said, these are great links in the show notes for you to go through and just read through and think about. And the reason I'm doing it now is, again, it's just kind of this, as you're starting into the new year and you're starting to think about new projects, new ways to do things, these are just some things to be thinking about and to kind of make sure that you're evaluating in yourself of, am I writing as quality code as I could be? Are there things I could be doing that are better and things that I could be doing that are more useful to my future self? So anyway, that's it for today's show. As always, if you have questions, comments, concerns, or complaints, I'm on Twitter @_DavidSmith. I'm on AppNet @DavidSmith. You can email me, david@david-smith.org, if you have questions about the show. Otherwise, I hope you have a good week, happy coding, and I'll talk to you on Thursday. Bye.